what I can see, like, overwhelmingly is like a sense of despair, I would say, from like younger generations. It's easy to actually fool people into thinking that they're making money and that things are going well, because even if you are investing, the value of your shares are going up and everyone's like, oh yeah, this is great. Meanwhile, if you look around you, it's like everyone feels like they can't spend any of their money. As somebody who still has a lot of life left to live, it feels like these decisions that are being made now are basically setting me up against my like will. Even when I feel like I'm leveling up and trying to get ahead, it feels like the goalposts are moving.
You being somebody who is under 30, you've gone to college, you've gone to be an engineer, you're going to get your master's in computer science, you're doing all these things that you're like, okay, I'm set. It reminds you of another Saylor quote, the system is rigged against you. Welcome to the show. Today I have the Bitcoin Bard with me, and I wanted to introduce you as a Bitcoin Army member. And I remember the first time I saw you post about what you were studying. Are you an aerospace engineer?
Yeah, my bachelor degree is in aerospace engineering. Right now I'm studying for my master's in computer science. So most of my professional work is in aerospace engineering, though. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's super fascinating to me, because when I first saw that, I was thinking about Saylor, and I told you that. I said that you're like Michael Saylor. You understand systems, and it's such an interesting, you know, passion to have, or an interesting area of study that you want to get into, because engineering is so complex, and aerospace engineering on top of it is probably the highest there is. I think it's probably like rocket scientist at that point. Is that what that is?
Yeah. I think it was something I didn't necessarily realize when I chose it, because you know, you have to choose basically in high school, and or maybe first or second year of college, figure it out. But one thing I definitely realized about aerospace engineering that was interesting or unique is that it's basically all of the other engineering disciplines combined under the specific lens of the aerospace industry. So like, we had a class on propulsion, and that's mostly like chemical engineering, but for aerospace. And we had classes on structures and things like that, and that was mostly mechanical engineering, but for aerospace application. And so I think like over the 4 years of the degree, you get like a really good broad understanding of the engineering discipline. And I think that that's like one of the reasons that it's so useful. I think personally, it's very useful because even if you don't end up going into aerospace engineering, you get like a really good understanding of all of these disciplines and how they interact to create a system that, you know, hopefully is very like useful and good at what it's designed to do.
Yeah. So where are you going to school?
My undergrad was at the University of Maryland, and my grad degree is at Georgia Tech right now.
Okay. And that's where you're at now?
No, I'm on the West Coast. The Georgia Tech program is fully remote.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's actually super, super nice. For one class, it's like $700, and you need to do 10 classes. So it's like $7,000 for a master's degree that, you know, over the course of 3 years or whatever that it takes, like that's entirely manageable to pay out of pocket, I think, for a master's degree. I was looking at a few other places like Johns Hopkins, where it was $7,000 per class. So it was literally 10 times the price. So I think Georgia Tech offers like a really great master's program, specifically in computer science, for people that either want to transition into computer science or just are already, you know, working full time, but want to kind of level up their game.
That's incredible. That's like they offer you the flexibility and for a cheaper price, where if you're paying all that money to go to a place like Johns Hopkins, you're paying to pretty much be in person, you know, and it's actually nicer to have the freedom, you know, to be able to not have to be, you know, going there physically, you know. So it's a really great option because you feel like you could do the same work and do it in the comfort of your own home. So I really love that they offer that. So were you always into, as a kid, were you always into, because I have a son who I always say he's going to grow up to be an engineer, because since he was like, he's 11 now, I'm sorry. But since he was like too, he was always breaking toys, and we're like, why do you break everything? And he's like, because like I'm not breaking it. Like, he just almost wants to see how sturdy different materials are and how, you know, tires come off of cars and different things. So he's always been this kind of kid that's interested in materials and how things are put together, and he's always kind of like taping things together and creating stuff out of random pieces of styrofoam. Or is that how you were as a kid?
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's something that has been the case for my whole life, and not even necessarily, you know, directly like how does like tinkering with things and doing these typical like engineering projects, but just like generally, I think a sign that somebody is well suited for engineering, and also I think a superpower, is like being curious and creative about how things work. And generally that's like something that I assumed everyone was, like, I assumed everyone had that curiosity. And what I've realized is that there's a lot of people who could care less, like how a toaster works or whatever the system is, you know, but like going through and like having a genuine curiosity of not just like how I can use this thing, but like how it actually works, is something that I think like that has served me very well in my career, and also was something that I recognized at sort of a younger age, that I was like, okay, not everyone is this way, but it is, that's a unique defining characteristic I feel like that I have.
Isn't it funny that you think, once you realize that, that you realize that not everybody in the world thinks the way you do, it's just kind of like shakes you. You're just like, whoa, this isn't how everybody's mind works. This isn't what everybody cares about so much. Like, I thought everybody wondered about these things. So it just totally shakes you. You see the world differently. You think, wow, they really just don't care. They don't care about the things that I think that are important and fascinating. And it also reminds me of what you said, because when we had our refrigerator stop making ice cubes because it just like it was frozen inside or something like that. And, you know, it had happened before, but it had stopped working. And then I think my son was maybe 9 at the time or something, or maybe 8. But our other two kids, one younger, one older, they didn't even care. We were talking about how the ice cube thing wasn't working. And my middle son was, you know, the one that I think is going to be an engineer, he started telling us, well, maybe it just, there's some frozen ice back in there and it needs to defrost, and then maybe it'll allow things to drip. And I don't know what he was saying, but he was saying all these things that sounded like, why do you even care? Why are you even like, you're a kid and you care to think about why the ice machine isn't working and why it could possibly be? Because somebody else, like my other kids, were just like, oh yeah, we're not even paying attention to you. We think that's a boring conversation.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's something that is worth like stressing to him as like a valuable trait, and that, you know, there are careers where that is like appreciated and expected, specifically in engineering. But, you know, for your other kids who like don't necessarily care about that, there's also careers where that's valued. Like, I know, like in my experience, sometimes, you know, I get bogged down in the weeds of, oh, I really need to understand how the system works. And meanwhile, somebody else has already like leapfrogged ahead because they didn't like bother themselves with like having to do that learning. And I think there's also like industries and careers where that's valuable. But, you know, it's just about finding, you know, being authentic with yourself and like seeing, you know, if I value that learning experience, do a career where, you know, that's valued. And so, yeah, I definitely felt like I was probably your middle child in that scenario. I have a twin sister. And so I think between me and her, we had like the complete opposites of like, she's very like humanities focused and like ephemeral. And I feel like I'm very much like down in the weeds of technical stuff. And
that's
so
funny.
I'm sure they probably also feel a similar kind of situation.
Dynamic. Yeah. That's definitely like they get along, but then they fight like crazy too. But they definitely have a lot of the same interests. But they have all these like three different distinct personalities. But it's just funny that you guys are twins and you're so opposite. But I'm sure you guys are super close, even though your personalities are so kind of different. So I'm also curious about when you understand systems, is because so many people have heard somebody like Michael Saylor speak and talk about Bitcoin, and they learn so much from him because he has a really good way of describing what Bitcoin is in a like a metaphor way where people understand how a system works, you know, because people just have a hard time defining new technology and understanding Bitcoin. So is that kind of how you found about Bitcoin? Like, did you look at it from the lens of like, what is this thing? Like, how is the system working?
Yeah, I think a little bit of, I guess, background on like how I even came into Bitcoin, was that like in 2013, I was still in high school at the time, and that like I found out about Bitcoin and I thought it was like the coolest thing. I bought some Bitcoin back then and I actually sold it for a loss, which is pretty hard to have done at that time. It was like $200 per Bitcoin. And so I kind of like stopped thinking about it. And, you know, 2017 rolled around and everyone's like hearing about Bitcoin for the first time. And I was like a little bit salty that I had sold my Bitcoin for a loss and it's now like $10,000 or whatever. So I wasn't really that invested in back then. And honestly, it hasn't been until this last like year or two that I've really gotten like gone all in with the intention of, you know, holding it for life. And I think part of that definitely I would attribute to Saylor and like the way that he's able to basically like invoke passion in the thing, regardless of if you truly understand it or not. And I think it's, I guess, you know, maybe this is a bit of a trope, but like the whole like orange pill like thing of just being the gateway into, you know, this world of Bitcoin. You know, I thought I understood Bitcoin back in 2013 when I bought it, and I had really not even known anything, you know, like it to me, I didn't even realize that there was a fixed supply at that time. Cause I was like, dude, we're mining Bitcoin all the time. And so, you know, I think a lot of what Saylor has done is brought some of these concepts immediately to the front. I think like one of the challenges with Bitcoin is that, it's like riddled with so many, you know, assumptions of what it is. And people have these like first impressions of just like crypto bros that are just like buying Lamborghinis and all this and all that. And I think, you know, like a lot of what has happened over the last few years is kind of reshaping that, like, I guess, public relations impression of what Bitcoin is. And I think that that has really opened the door for a lot of people to actually spend a little bit more time like understanding and diving deeper into it. But I think that also kind of goes back to what I was saying and like, and with your son about like actually understanding the systems, like the people that are buying Bitcoin in 2013 or now even are the people that are actually curious about like how it works. And some people got lucky, but a lot of people, you know, are genuinely looking at it and understanding like, okay, this is a fixed supply. I know for a fact, the government will be printing more money over the next few years and forever. So, you know, I think like people that are, that have that curiosity are attracted to Bitcoin. And that's makes sense why Michael Saylor is such a big proponent of it. Why I also find an interest in it. And probably your son would too, honestly, if he has that.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I do talk to them about it. You know, they do know, I think, more about Bitcoin than most adults, because we know that the amount of people that are in it right now is still a very small percentage of the population that understands it. So they do, even though they don't understand a lot, you know, but for kids, they understand a lot. You know, they understand a whole lot. They know that money is printed. They know that that keeps happening and that contributes to inflation. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because you'd be interested in Bitcoin. We were at this family event and he loves talking to adults. Like, he's not like, he likes talking to kids too, obviously, but he's always over there talking, like chatting it up with some grownups. And he was actually talking to my husband's uncle about money printing. But then you have my daughter. She goes around like being a promoter. She's telling her teachers, hey, do you know my mom has a podcast? It's called the Bitcoin Nova. And she's telling her teachers at school. So I'm like, you're so funny. Because this thing is happening now that they're young, they can like comprehend it easier than we did, you know, that you did, you know, when you found out about it in 2013. Yeah, you understood it. You were able to buy it, even though I'm sure back then it was not like today. You can't go on Coinbase and buy it. You had to have a laptop to laptop.
I barely remember it either, but I think I bought it on Mt. Gox at the time.
Oh man, that's crazy.
Yeah. And yeah, it was very much like download this piece of software and maybe it will work and please send some money and hopefully you'll get some fake things. And wow. So yeah, I never invested a lot, but you know, I thought it, you know, it was cool. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely completely different now. I think the kids like growing up with it as an option. The unfortunate thing is that there's so much grift that's attached with crypto that it's like really hard to differentiate Bitcoin. I see it as like something that's almost like this level of immaculate conception where, you know, it was this thing that was gifted to us. And, you know, there's nobody pulling the strings of trying to sell you Bitcoin and like dump their supply. But there are a lot of other cryptocurrencies where that is the case. And I think, you know, that's one of the biggest problems that Bitcoin has, especially with kids. But I do think that they see it as something that is more legitimate. And, you know, it's developed and designed online. And, you know, like that's the complete antithesis of like going to a physical bank to cash a check and get like dollars and put it in your savings account and things like that. Like kids don't want that. And like banks, some banks are, you know, trying to lean more in that direction. But at the same time, like people are realizing you don't even necessarily need a bank if you have other solutions.
The kids, that's why if they have like Bitcoin or parents, you just have to teach them from a young age. And I think that media narratives, they think that there's so much manipulation on purpose, because what people think about the crypto industry, they just associate Bitcoin with crypto. News outlets, mainstream media could have easily said, yes, this happened to FTX, but it doesn't mean that Bitcoin is unsafe. It doesn't mean that Bitcoin ever got hacked. Just to make that clear, you know, they just want to be like, look what happened to crypto, you know, and it just kind of puts this fear in your mind about Bitcoin being the same thing, where you have things that you hear about constantly where everything has gotten, AT&T has gotten hacked recently, like a few times. The US Treasury got hacked back in December, like twice. You know, the US Treasury, there's no clarification from legacy media that Bitcoin is a good thing and it hasn't gone down. You know, so I just think that's super weird.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, established people have a lot to lose from something like Bitcoin. And so I think that that's, you know, an uphill battle that will always be faced by, you know, the people who are, you know, it's like born out of frustration, I feel like, after the 2008 global financial crisis, that like, hey, let's design money from the ground up. Let's think about how it should actually work. And let's like stick it to the man, basically, and make it completely decentralized. Like, of course, the central authorities would have opposition to that. But I also think just generally that there's just a lack of understanding and a lack of like care to understand those things. And I think the situations that you've described require a level of nuance that is completely glazed over by media. And like another hack example, I guess, would be like the Binance situation with Ethereum a couple months ago now. You know, that's everyone saying like, oh yeah, this is why crypto will never work. They're just going to steal your crypto or whatever. And I think that that was a really good example of how, you know, when you add all of these like complexities of trying to be a differentiating factor in the crypto world, that it's easier to open the door for these sort of like hacks or social engineering attacks. And that's why I like the simplicity and beauty of Bitcoin, is that it has a lot of complexity under the hood, but ultimately, you know, it's, if you stick to Bitcoin, like it's pretty hard, as long as you're following good, you know, operational security, that, you know, it's pretty hard for you to actually get hacked. And Bitcoin as a network has not really ever been, you know, taken down or destroyed. And I think that that's, it's hard for people to understand given their existing like knowledge or scope of like central banks. And like, if you think about like, oh, I can't hack a real bank because they have all the money, you know, in a vault. And like, that would be like a bank heist, and that doesn't happen. But when it's on the internet, it's so easy. And the reality is, it's like orders of magnitude more challenging to, you know, crack somebody's private key and take their Bitcoin like address and or their Bitcoin wallet. But, you know, if people are losing their money to Bitcoin, it's more often than not due to like their own mistakes. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we don't see more Bitcoin adoption, is because it requires a level of like knowledge and understanding to not make silly mistakes and, you know, lose your money. Whereas if you do trust like the central banks and stuff, at least they do some due diligence to make sure that, you know, they don't lose your money, or they'll just add more zeros to your account to like make up for it at the end and eat the loss themselves. So I think that that's like one of those issues where there's a lot of people that just don't care enough to look into the news and actually like read what is happening. And they just listen to what people are saying. And the people that are giving the news don't understand, or, you know, if they do understand, don't have like a vested interest in portraying it like truthfully.
And that's why I like to use the word social engineering, because of all these reasons, because they know that people either don't care, or they've had trauma about fiat in the past where they don't care to talk about money, or they're just used to the idea of being paranoid or being conspiracy theorists. They think anyone who's like freaked out about, you know, the dollar or what's happening to our dollar, you're just crazy. We live in America. What are you thinking? You know, so it's like, don't question anything ever. They just want you to blindly trust. And it is a level of social engineering, because they understand how people think, their emotions about things. They know that people that are reporting it don't understand it either. So it's not hard to convince them to tell a story the way that they want it to be told. But it's as easy as teaching. Like, it doesn't take long to teach somebody, this is what cold storage is. This is what a seed phrase is. It's your password to your cold storage wallet. I try to explain that to people sometimes when they think it might not be safe. That's the beauty of Satoshi leaving a million Bitcoin in a wallet, because no one has access to that seed phrase. Nobody could ever access that Bitcoin. And it's proof. It's proof that no one's ever taken a single coin out of there. So that shows how safe it is. So it's as easy as if the media wanted to say, oh, cold storage, this is what it is. You know, teach more people about it. But it's not taught, because people don't care to find out about that stuff. And they think the bank is safe. At the same time, the government's heisting our banks all the time by creating more of a supply. So it's like, whatever you think you have in your savings account is within 4 years worth 40% less than it used to be. So now you could buy 40% less stuff than you used to buy. So technically, they did heist all the banks by enriching themselves and silently stealing your money without you knowing there's a bank heist going on. So they're just crooks. And I love to just constantly expose that. So if anyone's ever listening to my podcast that doesn't know Bitcoin, I just kind of like to randomly spit out there that you are being stolen from. It's just nice to educate yourself. It feels good. It feels freeing to finally get what this is. It's okay that you're late. Like, I got into it, and I got into it sort of not like you, not like Mt. Gox early. You know, it was in 2020, which a lot of people, I think, opened their eyes in 2020 due to the money printing. But it was one of those things where, yeah, we have to go through these phases of learning how to get burnt a little bit, most of us, by trading, by buying crypto or any other crap that you think is going to be the next Bitcoin, because you don't understand there is not going to be another Bitcoin. So it's happened to most of us, you know, that have gotten into it until we realize what it really is. So that's why this education is so important. And it's important to talk about it with your friends, you know, when people bring up, you know, the conversation, because more and more these days, as life gets harder, as things get more expensive, the topic comes up more often. You know, you want to try to go out with your friends. How many times, I don't know if you, like, how old you are and how it was for you a few years ago compared to now, but pre-COVID even, I feel like people used to just say, yeah, let's go out to dinner, like, more often. But now you hear people just being like, no, let's just like stay in and not go out, because we'll just spend so much more money and it's like too expensive. So people opt out of doing fun things they would normally do together socially because things are too difficult, and they try to like save money in different places that they can. They try to cut back on things they normally wouldn't have before. So it's kind of like you can talk to more people these days about Bitcoin. Because when the conversation comes up about how unfair things are or how expensive they are, where before people would dismiss you more easily, where now they're just kind of pissed off about it too. So they might actually listen. So it's kind of more important to talk to people now, because people see it and they feel it more.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think one of the things that where I'm sitting at, so I'm 28. And so I had a bit of an adult life before COVID started. And then, you know, COVID has changed a few things. But what I can see, like, overwhelmingly is like a sense of despair, I would say, from like younger generations. And I know that that's only going to get worse and is worse for people younger than me, where, you know, you have to be making like $100,000 to feel like you're okay, like, maybe I can go out, you know, sort of a thing, and or more. And I feel like, you know, like me personally, like it's challenging to feel like I can just, you know, let me just have a whole family and pay for everything and do all these things and give my kids like a fruitful life that they would like to lead. And And I think that that's representative of a lot of people my age and younger, where you look at fertility rates and they're plummeting, and all of these situations where, like you're saying, with the government basically stealing your money from the inside. I think, you know, the entire economic system is built on inflation, and we have this problem where if that ever changes, basically all the wheels fall off and everything kind of goes to shit. And I think that people know that, and they will make sure that, you know, inflation keeps going up. And I think that it's easy to actually fool people into thinking that they're making money and that things are going well, because, you know, even if you are investing, like the value of your shares are going up, and like everyone's like, oh yeah, this is great. Meanwhile, like if you look around you, it's like everyone feels like they can't spend any of their money because everything is so expensive, and going out on a date is like a $200 activity or something like that. And like, let alone having a child or multiple and being able to raise them and things like that. And so I think, you know, it's a bunch of like short-sighted decisions that I think something like the 2008 recession and also COVID like seasons people into realizing that the government mostly always is making short-term decisions that are beneficial in the short term, but ultimately like basically stealing from the future. And I think that that's one of the things that has been so like challenging and frustrating, is that, you know, as somebody who still has a lot of life left to live, it feels like these decisions that are being made now are basically like setting me up against my like will for a harder, more challenging life. Even when I feel like I'm like leveling up and trying to get ahead, it feels like the goalposts are moving further beyond where I'm moving to. And I think that that's, you know, a sentiment that is shared by a lot of people. So it's understandable that I think that a lot of people have this sense of despair and frustration. And I think like Bitcoin is an example of like an escape from that.
Yeah. And you being somebody who is at your age group, you're under 30, you've done so much. You've worked so hard. You've gone to college. You've gone to be an engineer. You're going to get your master's in computer science. You're doing all these things that are incredible that you think you'd be like totally comfortable and ready to start a family type of thing. You know, you're like, okay, I'm set. You know, that should be how you're feeling right now. And it's crazy because it's not like you just didn't go to college and you're just, you know what I mean? You're not just working just a random job, maybe just doing 2 years of your, you know, first 2 years of college, and then you quit and you're thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. Like you have a clear path. You've done everything you're supposed to. You're very intelligent to get to this point and get your master's in this area. And it reminds you of another Saylor quote, the system is rigged against you, you know, because you're doing all these things and you're still, the goalposts are moving. I like how you phrase that. And that's why I like to hear from people of all different age groups, because it just makes me wish that there was a movement among younger people to really understand Bitcoin and spread it like wildfire. Whether it's your age group or whether, like, I'm 41 now, and anyone in my age group who has kids, you also need to understand Bitcoin because you already have kids and you're like, what the hell am I going to do as things keep getting worse? But even for people like my parents' age who are planning to retire and they're feeling like they're not ready because they're struggling, you know, so people don't feel like they end up working till they're 80, you know, 75, 80, because they feel like they can't retire. They have to continue working. And that's not how life should be. So it feels like people of all ages really need Bitcoin, but especially younger people, when you have so much life ahead of you and you haven't started a family. You brought out that point about the plummeting birth rates. And it's something that I thought about a lot over the years. And I always thought that if I hadn't already had kids and then therefore looked for an answer to help better the future for the family, that was my reason for finding Bitcoin. But if I hadn't already had kids when I started to feel these things and this kind of pain, I would be questioning having kids. But there's a lot of younger people I spoke to also. I'm a hairdresser and I have clients, and there's some younger people that right when they start their life and they finish college and they think, okay, now it's the time of my life where I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be going out with my friends. I'm going to go buy something cute to wear, go out and have fun, you know, but it's like, no, instead we're just going to stay home and watch Netflix. Cause people used to just go, let's go shopping and buy new things for all the weekends we're going to be going out together. But now it's like people aren't going out that much. And that's why you feel like you don't even get to enjoy that adulthood phase that you're in. You see this despair that you said, except for in the Bitcoin world, people have found Bitcoin and they feel a sense of hope. I wish this would spread like wildfire amongst young people to realize that there is an answer and there is a problem, a clear problem. And, you know, a lot of us have been lied to our whole life. So it's just a great answer for all people of all ages, but especially young people who want to eventually start a family and feel like the goalposts keep moving.
Yeah, I think that, you know, everything has, especially like if you think about our country as a whole, there's like so much momentum, or I guess maybe inertia behind like the current system, and it's moving how it is. And it feels like we would need a drastic change to make an impact that would actually like turn that around. And the problem is like, even if we made that change today, it would take like a decade to actually like feel the repercussions of it. And I think that nobody has that long-term mindset except for like younger generations who will be there to feel the repercussions of it. And I think that the problem is a lot of people that are making the decisions are like the 70-year-old boomers that are, you know, they maybe have a decade left to live and they're, you know, just, well, if I inflate the economy, I'll make an extra 10-20%, and I don't care about the younger generations. And I don't know what the solution is, like, aside from getting younger kids more involved and being able to make the decisions themselves. I think one of the challenges is that you kind of have to, I feel at least, you have to experience like being burnt in some capacity to get that understanding of like, no, like we need to change the system. And I mean, like kind of what I was saying earlier with like Bitcoin being created as like an FU to the man out of the 2008 financial crisis. It's a very similar feeling where everything has been pushed to the extreme. Basically, like the only thing that's going up are the stock market, like the returns on your investments. But, you know, everything else of like sentiment and enjoyment and fulfillment are going down. And it's like, it doesn't matter because stocks are going up. And I think, you know, it takes basically like realizing that that's not going to change unless like you do something about it, or you like escape the system or whatever. And I think that it's hard for kids to necessarily realize that right off the bat. I think people around my age have been around enough at least to see the ramifications of poor decision making, but also have enough of like, hey, I'm going to be here for decades and I don't want to like basically be screwed around my whole life. And I think with the fertility rates and everything like that, like thankfully the United States is a country that everyone wants to, or a lot of people want to go to. And so we've been able to offset our poor fertility rates with immigration. And I think that we can, you know, sustain that for a while and basically like keep inflating the economy and increasing GDP by slowly increasing the population. But, you know, who knows if that's going to keep being a thing in the future. And like maybe 20, 30 years from now, like people won't want to come to the United States and we'd have like a fertility rate that's half of replacement. And now we're like basically crumbling because every year we're making less than we were before. And the whole economy is built on, you know, increasing GDP and inflation. So I think It's just one of those things where, you know, people are making poor decisions and it hasn't bit them yet, and they'll probably die before it matters. That hopefully won't be the case for me, but, you know, who knows? Maybe you never really know.
That's the great thing about listening to someone like you, is you see all of these intricacies in the system and you see all these different pieces of the moving parts of this machine. And it's not just one area or a couple areas. It's like all these things are connected, and you just think about the long-term impacts of everything that's going on at the same time. And it's a hard problem to fix, because when you think about all these things, it's mind-boggling and you're like, how will this be fixed? But you know that Bitcoin is an escape from that, and you know that you can exit a system where people steal from you and there's a fixed supply. And what I do like, when one person is pissed off enough, like you said, Satoshi was an FU to the system, and he was pissed off enough during, you know, 2008 that finally Bitcoin was released during this great financial crisis. But another FU was when Elon got pissed off enough to buy Twitter. And I really feel like a lot of things that would have been hidden, we got to see. And I was always very neutral in my political views. I only think that politicians all suck and they're liars and they steal from us. That's like my main political view is I just don't like government that steals from you. But when it came down to trying to figure out, well, what is Kamala going to do about the national debt and what is she going to do about this economy situation that we've been seeing crumbling in the last 4 years and all this money being like spewed everywhere? How are you going to help this? There was never any answer. And then we heard her speak and she sounded ridiculous. It was hard to watch sometimes, honestly, but and I wanted to be supportive of a woman, but I'm like, I just can't do it. I couldn't do it. And I think that if it wasn't for Elon buying Twitter, we wouldn't have seen those clips. It would have only been the clips on legacy media where she sounds perfect and very well rehearsed. But because X was purchased and you were allowed to see all these things that I think we maybe wouldn't have seen. And then now that allows for Doge to be exposing a lot of this theft. That is awesome to see. Like, I love when they have these meetings and they talk about everything that's been stolen. And I don't know if you saw it recently, but they were on Fox News talking about, you know, there's so many foundations that are fake foundations. There's money funneled through wars. There's all these different ways that they could steal that there was never required any proof of, you know, to say, hey, where's the receipt for all those tanks or whatever you're using for that war? Nobody's accounting for any of that. It just seems like there's some sort of glimmer of hope alongside Bitcoin being a new foundation.
Yeah, I definitely agree that I think there's a lot of wasteful spending. I just looked it up. I think it was Korea that is like really low replacement rates. They're at like 0.75, which is 2.1 is replacement. So 0.75 is like for every couple, there's less than one child. And that's, you know, obviously one, I think it was like one or two generations in the future, they're going to be like a tenth of the size that they currently are, unless things change. And I think that once that starts happening, it's very challenging. You see with like China even has basically been eclipsed by India in their population because of the decisions that China made 20, 30 years ago with the one child policy and having its ramifications now. So yeah, it's definitely something that is a concern for me, especially like as a younger adult. But yeah, I think on the waste and abuse side of the coin, that yes, I do agree. There's a lot. One from at least aerospace that I know of, because that's the industry I'm in, is that Boeing was charging, you know, the federal government like $150,000 for soap dispensers on one of their airplanes. And it's like a $5 part that they're, you know, like it's because the plane's like $100 million that like, oh yeah, $100,000 for a few soap dispensers probably makes sense, but nobody's like going through with a fine-tooth comb and like doing the math of like, okay, where are we get, like what's this money going towards? And I think being in the industry, it's like pretty obvious that, you know, there's a lot of abuse. The company that I work for is, you know, really trying to tackle this head on. I think in the defense industry at least, there's a lot of existing companies, like the big primes, which basically are like resting on their laurels of like, if I can get a contract for like the F-35 fighter jet, for example, it's going to be billions and billions of dollars. And if I can make it more expensive, they have to pay for it based on how the contract is written. And if I take much longer, they have to pay me more money because I'm spending more time developing it. So like the incentives are misaligned between the government and the companies that are doing these developments. And I think, you know, that's one of those things where like, yes, I think passively I'm doing my part by investing in Bitcoin and kind of like trying to escape from this whole system. But also like, what are you doing actively to help this situation? And I think like that's where I'm able to contribute is like we're basically like using money to build things up front and then basically showing it to the government, being like, hey, we have this cool thing. This is how much it costs. And if you want it, like here. And so like it's a much better alignment of incentives where we have the incentive to make it as cheap as possible so that it's like a really valuable thing that costs us not a lot to make, and also means like we don't want to spend 2 decades making something that should take 6 months to make. And I think that that has really like made me feel a lot better about like where I fit in the world and where I'm contributing to society, and that like I feel like I'm actively working at getting, you know, the taxpayer better value for their dollar. And I think that that's something that, you know, everyone has somewhere where they can make that impact. And it might not be directly in your career or whatever. But yeah, if you are upset about it, like, figure out how you can kind of, you know, make a change. Because yeah, there's a lot of waste, there's a lot of abuse. I think, you know, I guess one other thing, and then I'll get off my pedestal, is that, like, the like controlling the narrative will always be something that is designed, or like people are all, will always be attempting to control the narrative. And I think regardless of if you're like a Musk proponent or not, or if you are like super liberal and you liked how Twitter was before, I think one of the challenges that we face is like basically creating a bunch of echo chambers, and where you'll be able to be in an environment where you can get your feelings validated and never get to experience any other perspective. And I think that that's a challenge. That will always be a challenge. I think, you know, Twitter was not great. It was feeling a little echoey, chambery, but, you know, there's always going to be that risk. And I don't know what the solution is for that. But I think, like, instilling in kids and, you know, everyone of having this like critical thinking mindset is a superpower as well, where, you know, you have to take in the totality of the information and be able to come to your own consensus on what, like, what you think is right. And I think that there's so many people that don't really care about doing that. They're just, you know, being fed information, or whether they realize it or not, just scrolling through their algorithms and seeing what they're seeing. And I think that's dangerous. And I see that as like a major risk to younger generations, where, you know, they're spending 6-7 hours just scrolling through short form media. And, you know, like, where's, you're basically just a monkey at that point, like just receiving data and like being impacted. And I don't know what the solution is, but
yeah,
none of it's really been great. I'm glad, you know, Musk has bought Twitter and is trying to make it like free speech. I worry that it's just going to create more echo chambers of people that are upset about it that go somewhere else. And so I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right about that. And I agree with you 100% with critical thinking being something that you need to teach kids. Like, people always want kids to just follow rules and never question authority. And it's okay to let them feel that out and see why, what they think about it, and then maybe compromise, and they could show them their strength when it comes to their ideas. And it's kind of nice to let them express that confidence, to show that they have an opinion and it's okay to share it. So critical thinking is great. I'm glad you mentioned that word. I also think it's amazing what you're doing with trying to make a change in the world, trying to make cheaper products. And I think that's what the advances in technology will allow us, with more people doing more jobs and being more creative and coming up with solutions for things, is it's going to create a deflationary force with the rate at which you could produce these things and how cheap you could make them, alongside actually having things be transparent as far as receipts and requiring receipts, and, you know, not just allowing people to just write a blank check for something that didn't really cost that much, but asking for accountability. Like, how much did these products actually cost? There's the receipt. Perfect. They made it for this much money. That's truth right there, is transparency. And that's what, you know, I think a lot of younger people, they want to see this kind of a world. We're done with these lies, and we're done with seeing all the fake, you know, theft that's been happening over the years. So it's nice that you're actually doing something with your company to try to provide solutions and actually build equipment that is realistic in how much things cost. It just reminds me of when people say they go to a hospital and they get a Tylenol, on the bill it says it was $1,000. You're like, really? Okay. So that's how overpriced things are. It's ridiculous. As far as the decentralization and the echo chamber part of it, I know a lot of people don't use it very much yet. It's still very new. But do you know about Noster?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it would be nice if more people in the future, as more platforms get built, not to have some kind of algorithm judging what's going to be seen and where, and people can just post. And I feel like the future of some more social media will be a Noster-based open source sort of platform that would have something like monetization, where it could be people just tipping each other for their content because they appreciate it, instead of waiting for monetization. Plus all the censorship that happens on X, even though we saw a lot of things that we wouldn't have seen. My account's gotten suspended. I wasn't able to get it back, but somehow I got a human agent that contacted and they were able to get it back. I don't know how in the world that happened. And then since then, I've had to, you know, prove that I'm a human multiple times. I'm not even spamming and hashtagging and commenting a lot. I don't know why it keeps asking me. So it's just super weird. And then I had a separate page for my podcast that got suspended a few weeks ago, and I'm not able to get anyone to respond to that. So it's not free speech in that way when you know you're getting suspended. So I don't completely think it's the best place ever, but it's better, I think, than it used to be, just based on the things that are allowed to be said, you know, and not totally suppressed by a government or something. But there are places like Noster that are being built that are what will end up being in the future. And that will help people break out of these echo chambers in a way, I hope. So we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that Noster is a great step in the right direction. I think that Noster will face a similar challenge that Bitcoin faces of, you know, like the technologically savvy individual will be the first one on the platform. And I don't think it will be a while until, you know, it sees vast adoption, like where it's easy enough as, you know, signing up for an account on Twitter or X to, you know, sign up on Noster. And I think that that's like one of the challenges is you have to have a little bit more intelligence and a little bit more like desire to be in that environment.
I don't know when you joined it, but I do have to say that when I first got on there, I felt like I needed to know how to code to somehow get a page. It was super hard to use. Even when it came to your profile picture or your banner photo, you had to input code from something or another and have that show up. And I thought that was crazy. I'm like, how is this ever going to be something mainstream? But then I went on there recently and I did change my banner and my profile photo, and you can easily change it as much as you do on Twitter now. So they've already upgraded that aspect of it. So I'm sure signing up the account is a lot easier compared to when it was maybe when you signed up. But that just shows you how fast things adapt, you know, and how much a year ago it could have been like, oh my God, you have to know computer code to get on here. And I think it's because it was so new and it's growing up.
Yeah, I agree. I'm hopeful that it will get to the point where it's basically as frictionless as possible while still you know, respecting the fact that you don't want some central authority that's deciding what you see. And I think, you know, there's always going to be people that are trying to like game the algorithm for their advantage, but I definitely think it's in alignment with what I was saying about aligning incentives. Noster, it seems like, you know, if you are genuine with the content you make, you would get rewarded for it versus somewhere like Twitter or X, where it's like, however many reps you can put in, like however many tweets you can blast out just to the void, that will be your path to wealth. And like, I don't think that that's a genuine way to be contributing to society. And it basically like incentivizes people to just be, you know, spamming the most like obscene things because it's, you know, it's like clickbaiting, you know? And I think that's one of the things that I like a lot about Noster is you can spend the time to think about something genuine and share that and not feel like you have to, you know, put 1,000 tweets in a week just to like meet the quota of like, oh, I need to hit this many impressions or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I gave up on the impression thing. I was trying to do it for a while when I first started interacting with people more. And now I haven't checked my impressions for a very long time. I'm sure it's still stuck at the same stage. So it's like, and I'm not frustrated about it. Whatever happens, happens. If it happens, cool. But I just wanted to feel like not a job for me. You know, I wanted to feel like I'm enjoying it. So thank you so much, though, for joining me today. It was really nice talking to you and getting to know you. And I'm excited about the future. I'm excited that you're a Bitcoiner, and I'm excited about what you're doing for the world, making cheaper products and realistic expectations of what things should cost and setting like a benchmark for that. So that's really great to hear.
Sweet. Yeah, no, thank you so much, Stacey. I appreciate having me on, and also, you know, all the work that you're doing for, you know, spreading the good word. And I wish you all the best, and hopefully you can continue being successful in that, because we need more people that are doing that.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. You have a great rest of the day, and I can't wait to share this with everybody so they can see our Bitcoin Army version of a sailor that we have in our group. So
yeah, no worries. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Have a good day.
See you too.